Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm your host, Rita Peters, along with my co-host, Mark Meckler. And I have to stop right here and let everyone know that today's Mark's birthday. Happy birthday, Mark.
Well, thank you for embarrassing me here live on air, but there's nobody I'd rather spend it with. It's so great to be with you.
Thank you. Well, I'm so glad you're with us. Today, we are going to talk about President Biden's new Supreme Court nominee, and we're going to discuss a little bit his methodology, because I have a little bone to pick in the way he chose to go about selecting his nominee and the way he made the announcement about it. And then we're going to talk about what are the right qualifications that we need to be looking for when we go to nominate a judge to serve on the highest court in the land? What should we be asking? What are the questions that matter? And Mark, as we get started here, I would consider you a political junkie. How closely do you follow Supreme Court nominations and hearings?
Yeah, I follow them, honestly, more closely than I would like to have to follow them. And what I mean by that is, yeah, I'm a political junkie. I find it interesting. But unfortunately, I think the Supreme Court has become so much more important in our political life than it was ever intended to be by the founders, mm-hmm. that it requires that we pay very, very close attention to the selection process, to who's ultimately nominated, what their judicial philosophy is, what their history is. I wish we didn't have to pay such close attention to those things, but we do, and I definitely do that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you say that. I think you're exactly right that it is sort of a mark of dysfunction of the branches of government that it's such a big deal because, you know, the court was intended by the founders, as we know, to be the weakest of the three branches. It was intended just to decide cases, to apply written rules to specific factual situations and come out with the outcome. But what we have today, or have had for decades now, is a court that actually makes a lot of the most fundamental public policy decisions in the nation. And that's not how it's supposed to be, right?
It's actually become what I would call a supra-legislature.
Yeah.
In other words, it sits over the legislature, and it actually makes law. And we have numerous examples of this in recent history. Probably the most blatant I recall from recent history is the decision on Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And they literally made law out of that. It was clear that that didn't fit within constitutional bounds. They rewrote the law. They restated the intention of Congress as to what Congress actually meant in that case so that they could uphold it. This is not what the Supreme Court was intended to do. They were never intended to make law. They were never intended to twist congressional intent to uphold or to overturn things. So it's now serving as a legislature deciding the most fundamental public policy issues. It can go back to the 1970s, 1973 Roe versus Wade. They actually are weighing in on a public policy issue, and they invent a right in the Constitution, a right to abortion, which obviously is not in the Constitution. It's outrageous morally, of course, or religiously, of course, but it's also outrageous as a matter of law. This is not the Supreme Court's role.
Right. So what we had with Roe versus Wade, for instance, was the Supreme Court mandating that every state in the nation allow what effectively is abortion on demand. So, you know, if you're listening to this program, you're thinking, well, what does this have to do with the intersection of faith and culture? Well, it has so much to do with it, because the court has, for better or for worse, I think for worse, become so powerful in today's America. So I'm going to kick us off with just a little recap of what has led us to this point. Justice Breyer announced recently his plan to retire at the end of the current Supreme Court term. Of course, he's known to be one of the more liberal justices. He pretty much always sides with that portion of the court that comes down liberal on various public policy issues, which again, we don't think they're supposed to do, but it is what it is. Now, President Biden vowed to nominate the first Black woman to the Supreme Court. So he has now nominated Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, and we'll talk about her and her qualifications in just a minute. But Mark, before we do that, remind us a little bit about the process. How do Supreme Court justices get installed? Who makes the decision?
Initially, obviously, as has happened, they are nominated by the President of the United States. And then that goes to the Senate for their what's called advice and consent. Mm-hmm. And so usually the nominee goes around Capitol Hill, meets with the senators on both sides of the aisle, has conversations with them. And that's in preparation then for committee hearing. In the committee hearing, the nominee sits before the committee, questions are asked. Unfortunately, we've seen that incredibly highly politicized in recent years, probably going all the way back to the Bork nomination is when we saw that really start in full-throated attack through Clarence Thomas, Brett Kavanaugh, obviously. And so there's a process where there's a committee hearing and then there's a vote on committee and then it goes to the full Senate floor and the Senate will vote to confirm that nominee or to reject that nominee.
Yeah. And we already alluded to this, but really the nomination process, unfortunately, has become sort of a three-ring circus. I'm trying to remember which justice it was. I think it may have been Kavanaugh, that at one point people are actually having him read from his calendar, his planner from many, many years back. And it's just this probing thing, which again is only happening because the court has become so active. And I mean that in a bad way. The court's not meant to be socially active on a policy way, but they are. And so it is really important to everyone, the internal workings of the nominee's mind and anything they've ever written, any opinion they've ever given. Now, my understanding is that the Senate Judiciary Committee is set to begin hearings on Judge Jackson on March 21st. So let's talk about her a bit. Her judicial career began in 2012 when she was nominated by President Obama for the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia. Last year, President Biden tapped her to serve on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. She earned both her undergraduate and law degrees from Harvard. She was chosen to be editor of the Harvard Law Review, which is quite an honor. She, as I understand it, is an expert on the plea bargaining process and on federal sentencing guidelines and has done a lot of work in those areas. So I have to say, professionally, educationally, she seems qualified to me to serve on the Supreme Court. Would you agree with that, Mark?
Yeah, I think she's more than qualified. She clerked for Supreme Court Justice. Mm-hmm. You know, she comes out of the Ivy League. She's been a lawyer. She's been a judge. But now I'm gonna put a big caveat in there. I don't necessarily like all of that stuff. and I feel like one of the things that's going on with the Supreme Court right now is almost all of the justices who are sitting on the Supreme Court right now have clerked for justices.
Yes.
And I understand why they do that, but it's become this very elite club. And I don't think that's good. I think that the Supreme Court should, as a matter of course, it's not the law, but kind of reflect the American people. Mm-hmm. Right now, the Supreme Court comes primarily out of Ivy League schools. I think that's a problem, too. They have a particular ideology, unfortunately, a political ideology, which is very left-leaning, very socially liberal. The law schools are radically leftist mm-hmm. and liberal at this point. And so what that means is you end up with a particular culture on the Supreme Court that's not representative of the broader culture in the United States of America. So while I would say on an individual basis, there is no doubt that she is qualified to sit on this court, whether she's a great choice based on where she comes from and her similarity with the background of so many other justices, that's a debatable issue.
That's a great point, Mark. I want to talk a little bit about her personal attributes, and I've done a little bit of reading about her and interviews of her friends and colleagues. She's known as a really hard worker, someone who stayed really focused on her studies and on her career. And a lot of what came out in interviews was stories of how she, at various times, resisted temptations to get sucked into various social causes. And an interview for the Washington Post, she recalled her parents teaching her that unlike the many impenetrable barriers that they had to face, her path was clear, she said. And so she really carried that forward. And at times when acquaintances may have wanted her to react to various instances of racism and other forms of injustice, she really chose her battles and buckled down and stayed focused on her goals rather than becoming sidetracked. In a 2017 speech, she said, and I quote, "Girls like my daughters need to learn that they have opportunities in America today, opportunities that don't exist for girls in many other countries." So she obviously loves America. She once told a Black student group at the University of Chicago, and I quote, "If we're going to get to where we belong, we can't keep stopping and fretting over random ridiculousness." And I really love that. I mean, her focus is just admirable. So, Mark, I have to say that in this brave new world we're in today with critical race theory and people hating on America all over the place, I find this really refreshing. Is it surprising to you at all?
It is surprising to me because from a public-facing perspective, from what she speaks about and how she speaks, she does not fit the mold of the modern American left.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think one of the most interesting things about this is the juxtaposition, or frankly, the alignment between she and Clarence Thomas on the broader view of Black people in America today. And unfortunately, Justice Thomas has been called a racist or Uncle Tom or a bunch of other more horrible things for saying these kinds of things. But he's always said, look, nobody's holding me back, right? Nobody's holding the Black people I know today. They're going to law school. Nobody's holding them back. We have opportunity that our parents didn't have, that our grandparents didn't have. She's saying the same thing. So one of the interesting things for me is going to be watching how this unfolds. Because, again, he's been called Uncle Tom and a racist, and he's actually been called a mouthpiece for white supremacy. Ugh. She's saying virtually the same words as Clarence Thomas, so I'll be curious how the left treats this.
Yeah, me too. So I've kind of set the stage here. We have this professionally qualified person, and I think most reasonable people would say that her education, intelligence, experience, and background all make her well-suited for a seat on the Supreme Court. And just to be clear, I'm putting aside her policy views for now. So in this context, I have to say, Mark, I think it is an absolute shame that President Biden started the process with this vow to appoint the first Black woman to the Supreme Court. I think that by couching his choice in this affirmative action type language, Biden really tainted America's view of Jackson's competence. She is deserving of admiration and respect, regardless of her skin color or gender. And I think what Biden did by starting out and saying, I'm narrowing the field here, I'm not going to consider men, I'm not going to consider white women, I think that was a huge insult to her. What do you think?
I completely agree with that. And I'm going to put it in more blunt terms, Rita, and apologize for being so blunt here. But what he said was racist.
Yes.
And so he just behaved in a straight up old white man racist way. It was pandering. It was demeaning. And I agree with you. Again, judicial philosophy aside, this is an incredibly accomplished woman. Everybody, regardless of our judicial philosophy, should look at her and say, man, That's a story. She's accomplished great things. She's done incredible things. She is the classic lift yourself up by your bootstraps and make it happen. As you said, her friends talk about her focus, her commitment, her dedication, her work ethic. All of these things are what she should be held up for, not for her gender or her skin color. So I hope that, you know, my prayer for America is that we get past this, because unfortunately the left is infusing the most vile sort of racism into American society. And when I say the most vile sort, what I mean by that is it's an underhanded sort of racism. Mm-hmm. It's one thing for people just to be blatantly racist and say horrible, you know, use terrible epithets and things like that. But at least we can point at that people and know it's just obvious racism. Those people are bad and evil. But when somebody does it in this underhanded way, and undercuts a person of color's qualifications by saying they were chosen for their skin color, their gender, that's a form of racism that's really insidious and very dangerous.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's surprising to me that more people don't seem to recognize that. And maybe it's not that they don't recognize it. Maybe it's that people are just afraid to call it what it is because they'll be on the wrong side and then they'll get labeled somehow as a racist. Do you think that's what it is? Do people not recognize it, or are people just afraid to call it what it is?
You know, I think it's the latter. I think more people are just afraid to call it what it is. And I look, this is a big problem in our society right now, that especially on the left, that they say things, it's actually become a religion. If, you know, they have a worldview that's central to the way they view the world and themselves. Part of it is the language they use and the way they speak. I would describe that as a liturgy. And then it's very tribal on the left, that if you don't ascribe to this worldview, if you don't participate in the liturgy, you're excluded from the tribe. Wokeism is actually definitionally at this point a religion in the United States of America. And every religion has a way of enforcing its ethos, enforcing its liturgy on folks. And that's what the left does in regard to racism. This is actually straight up racism, but it's the accepted liturgy of the American left.
Yeah, that's right. So it's called affirmative action today, but to be clear, it is an insult to the minorities that it claims to favor. And it actually embitters the people who had to compete solely on the basis of merit. Do you think, Mark, that policies like this over the past several decades have contributed to the racial unrest that we see in America today?
Yeah, look, I would rely on what Clarence Thomas says. You know, here's a guy that lived his way through that, who got into elite law schools, who got the jobs at the good law firms, who got jobs in administration on his own qualification. But he also knew that there were people who were looking at him wondering, well, is he here because he's qualified, or is he here because of affirmative action?
Yeah.
And folks who live in that environment, people of color who live in that environment, have to know that other people questioning that. You never know. Now, we know because of her history that this nominee, she's here because of her own qualifications. But I mean, it wouldn't be unreasonable to ask, well, how did she get into Harvard Law? How did she become the lead of the Harvard Law Journal? Not because we doubt that she's qualified, but because we know there are affirmative action processes in place that might have benefited her. And I think that's horrifying because she seems like an entirely competent human being.
Yeah. So the mere existence of those policies causes people to ask questions or make assumptions that they otherwise wouldn't be asking and wouldn't be making. It's sort of instilling a sort of bias that I think is terrible. So let's talk about whether Ketanji Brown Jackson is a good nominee to replace Breyer. So far, we've focused on her professional skills, experience, and qualifications. What people tend to do, which, again, we've already alluded to a bit, is to focus on the nominee's political and policy views. Now, if we do that, I am somewhat concerned, merely because she is a favorite of left-wing special interest groups, including People for the American Way, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, Planned Parenthood Federation, NARAL, Pro-Choice America. Does she actually agree with all of their policy views? I really don't know. I don't know that all of that information is out there yet. But Mark, should it matter whether she agrees with them?
Well, there's theory and practice. In theory, it shouldn't matter at all.
Yeah.
Because in a position, sitting on the bench, a judge, whatever their personal philosophy about abortion is or gay marriage is or any of the hot, but it should not matter. Mm-hmm. Because they should be able to divorce their decision-making, their analysis of the law and facts from those things. That's the ideal. Unfortunately, and especially at the level of the appellate courts and the Supreme Court nowadays, somebody's stances on the issues do matter, because it seems that nowadays the standard is most judges that we see publicly in the big cases are deciding based on these kinds of ideologies as opposed to the law and facts. So while I wish it didn't matter, in practical reality, it matters quite a lot.
Yeah, we've talked about this on the program before, but we unfortunately live in a day and age where a lot of people have really bought into this idea that the Constitution is this organic document. And I remember how much Justice Scalia used to hate when people would tell children, "We have a living Constitution." And he used that voice one time when I heard him speak about it. And he actually said, "People, the Constitution that I apply isn't alive, it's dead." And of course, what he meant was, the words of the Constitution have a certain meaning. It's the meaning that they were understood to have when the Constitution was written. The language is not just endlessly malleable. It doesn't just mean whatever people want it to mean. But in a day and age when so many people really buy that idea of the organic Constitution, it really does matter what a judge's policy views are, unless they understand that it's not their job to apply their policy views.
You know, I love that story about Scalia. And interestingly, my son is a senior at Scalia Law right now. Mm-hmm. And that frustrates him immensely. And he gave an example of this idea of an organic constitution to me that, to me, is the best example I've ever heard. He said, you know, every one of us has entered into a contract as adults at some point in our life. And then whatever is in that contract has to happen after you sign the contract. And he said, imagine if you went in to buy a car and you said, I want that red Toyota Camry right there on the lot, that one right there, I'm going to pay $10,000 for it. They agreed. You signed the contract. And then they said, okay, you know, we'll get it all detailed up for you. And you come back tomorrow and you pick it up. And you come back tomorrow and they say, there's your car. And it's a different car. It's got a lot more miles on it. It's kind of beat up. And you say, that's not the car we agreed on. And they said, oh, yeah, that's okay. But we have a living contract. So this is, you got to understand, circumstances change. And so we've now interpreted that differently. And we interpret it that that's the car you bought. And you laugh because it's so ridiculous. But the Constitution itself is a contract. It was written between we, the sovereign people, and the government that we created. And it meant something at the time. And the idea that you could actually write a contract that had no fixed meaning, it makes no sense in any other area of our life that we could imagine. And the idea that people say that the most fundamental document in our system of governance doesn't actually have a meaning, and that the men who wrote it and the people who signed it and the people who ratified it didn't understand it to mean something certain. They felt like, well, that might change tomorrow. It might mean something entirely different. It's just actually ridiculous.
Yeah, it really is. I would go so far as to say, if you believe we have an organic constitution, then you don't believe we live under the rule of law, right? Because that's what the rule of law is. It means that our laws are written down and we have to stick to them, that we're not governed by the whims of individuals or what they think the Constitution should mean. So we've talked about, Mark, why it shouldn't matter what a judge's policy views are, although in today's climate, it very often does. Let's talk about what we should be looking for in a Supreme Court justice. What do you think are the most important qualifications?
So this goes back to what we were just talking about, and how does somebody view the law and fundamentally, how do they view the Constitution? And what I'm looking for is what is commonly referred to as an originalist or a textualist. And I actually, there's a word that I like to use here, is somebody who is a contextualist. And what I mean by that is they understand the text of the Constitution within the context that it was written. So they're looking back to the founders and saying, when they wrote this, you know, when they wrote Article 5, which is one we talk about constantly, what did they mean at the time? Because that's the meaning. It's not, and we don't look at it in light of the history that's happened since. We look at what the founders, what the framers actually meant when they were writing these things. We know that. We have the notes, Madison's notes from the Constitutional Convention itself. We have the Federalist Papers, which were these intense debates taking place all over the country, people debating what those who had proposed the Constitution meant. So what I'm looking for is somebody who has the judicial philosophy that I'm going to go back and look at what the framers actually meant in the context of the time, and I'm going to apply that to whatever is before the court in the current day.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that is the number one most important thing we should be looking for in a Supreme Court nominee in particular. You know, I do believe that it is possible for judges to have the integrity to apply the Constitution as it was written, even when it produces a result they don't like. And so, in addition to how they will interpret the language, which you pointed out, I think the questions we ask of judicial nominees need to focus on figuring out whether or not they will be the kind of justice who is faithful to interpret the law as it is written, even in that scenario when it produces a result they don't like. Do they believe the role of a judge is to apply the law as it is? Or some of them, I think, actually believe that it is their job as a judge to facilitate social change by their creative interpretation. So we need to know if Ketanji Brown Jackson is strong enough to be more faithful to the law than her own personal policy views.
I agree with that, but I also want to mention to people, we tend to look at this through a partisan lens, and it doesn't always work out that way. And so we know, for example, that Justice Roberts has manipulated his view of the law in order, in his view of the Constitution, in order to, in his words, protect the institution.
Yeah.
He's protecting the institution over the Constitution. And so he'll manipulate his decisions in a way that he believes are best for the institution of the Supreme Court. We saw Justice Kennedy do this in the Obergefell gay marriage decision, where he basically said, look, we need to make sure everybody can define their own reality, their own existence, what the meaning of life is. And these are philosophical, social positions that have no place on the Supreme Court. And it's not limited by party. It's not limited by political ideology. It's about judicial philosophy.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. We need a Supreme Court that is more faithful to the Constitution than to the institution of the court itself. Mark, we're just about out of time. Quickly, how do you see the rest of the nomination process playing out? Do you think she gets the nod?
I do think she gets the nod, and I do think that the Republicans are likely to play pretty nice. I think that might frustrate some people after what happened in the Kavanaugh hearings.
Yeah.
But unless there's something really outrageous that comes out of her past, I think there'll be some pointed questioning, some difficult moments. You know, you're going to see politicians trying to score points, because this is what it's mostly about, is sound bites for the politicians.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling, you know, I would say with pretty strong certainty, she's going to end up seated on the United States Supreme Court.
All right. Well, there you have it from Mark Meckler. And that's all the time we have for today. We want to thank our generous sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services, Blessings Christian Bookstore, Sunshine Ministries with Christian Radio, Wishing Well Florists and Travel Services, and our good friends at New Beginnings Church and Garber's Church of the Brethren in Harrisonburg. I'm Rita Peters with Mark Meckler and engineer Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week for another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet.